Good morning and welcome to Let's Talk New Mexico. I'm your host, Ty Bannerman. On March 1st, 1973, UNM student and member of the Navajo Nation, Larry Casus, kidnapped the mayor of Gallup for several hours before the standoff ended in the death of the young activist. But what was the context for this tragic event, and how does the history of colonization and exploitation of Native Americans in the U.S. factor into the conditions that he was protesting against? On today's Let's Talk New Mexico, we will be discussing Larry Casus's legacy and the racist politics that led to his actions that day, as well as how they continue to impact members of the Navajo Nation and Native Americans across our state. And we want to hear from you. How do you think we should remember controversial figures like Larry Casus? And how should towns bordering Native American communities work to end anti-Native racism? Call us at 505-277-5866. Email your thoughts to letstalk@kunm.org or tweet to us using the hashtag #LetsTalkNM. I have two guests with me in the studio this morning, David Correa. He is the author of the new book, An Enemy Such as This, Larry Casus and the Struggle for Native Liberation in One Family on Two Continents Across Three Centuries, as well as a professor of American Studies here at UNM, and Dr. Jennifer Dennettdale. She is the chair of the Navajo Nation Human Rights Commission, as well as chair of UNM's American Studies program, and the author of Reclaiming Diné History, The Legacies of Navajo Chief Manuelito and Juanita. Thank you both for coming in today.
You're welcome.
Good morning, Yate.
So, David, let's start with you. So, who was Larry Casus, and can you take us through what happened on March 1st, 1973?
There are probably a lot of listeners who don't need an introduction, and they're probably mostly Navajo, who know Larry well and know what happened on that day in March 1973 and don't really need any explanation for why he did what he did and why that was important. But I imagine there's a lot of listeners who aren't familiar with Larry or who maybe only heard his name once or twice and maybe know only what you just said to open. Mm-hmm. The point of writing this book, which I've spent years doing and with the help of my colleague Jennifer and also Larry's family, his siblings, many of whom still live in the Gallup area, was to try to deepen the context to explain that last day of his life, which is a really desperate day and an incredibly dramatic day, and really the least interesting thing about Larry Casus. He was an incredibly thoughtful, intelligent young man. He was the president of the Kiva Club, one of the longest student groups in the U.S. It's a native student group at UNM. He was a member of a group called Indians Against Exploitation that for years had been trying to shut down the Gallup Intertribal Ceremonial in Gallup, which at the time was the largest tourist event in the state of New Mexico, the most profitable event in Gallup, completely run by the Chamber of Commerce, white businessmen, not at all Native-led or determined by Native people, and you know, just had commodified the ceremonies and traditions of the Diné for tourism purposes. Larry had always had his attention specifically on Emmett Garcia, the mayor of Gallup, because Emmett Garcia was also the owner of the most profitable but also most notorious bar and liquor store in the state of New Mexico, the Navajo Inn. And there's a chapter at the end of the book specifically around Gallup, which Larry and his and the other political organizers that he worked with called the City of Exploitation. You know, the entire economy of Gallup then and now is organized or is an extractive economy that doesn't flourish despite of the suffering and misery of Native people, but entirely because of it. And you know, the Navajo Inn was the perfect example of all that misery. Every winter, dozens of people would be found dead in the ditches and arroyos near and around the Navajo Inn, which was 20-some miles north of Gallup, but right along the Navajo Nation border. People hit by cars, people beaten by teenagers white teenagers who engaged in what is known as Indian rolling, murdering brutally, particularly inebriated Diné men or women. The coroner almost routinely called it exposure deaths. This still happens. It goes on. Larry had spent years trying to shut down the Navajo Inn, at the very least, even just move it from the road. There was enormous attention in the 70s on the Navajo, and the New Yorker, in fact, was writing pieces about it, how brutal that the whole scene around it was, and the refusal of the city to do anything about it, to confront the problem, because, of course, it wasn't a problem to the white economic elite in Gallup. It was the reason why they were profitable and why they made money. And so, you know, on that desperate day, Larry and another young activist, Robert Nakata, and I kidnapped. They actually, near where we're sitting right now, they kidnapped another UNM student at gunpoint and forced him to drive them to Gallup, and where they kidnapped the mayor and held him hostage. Larry died in a I hesitate to even call it a gunfight, because it was mostly just the police firing tear gas and weapons into a sporting goods store where Robert and Larry had holed up. This, you know, over the years, people, when they get defensive in Gallup, non-Native people, when they get defensive, claim that Larry killed himself. He didn't. I think the book demonstrates and shows that the police killed Larry after they had already wounded him, and after he was unconscious. But what I try to do in this book is demonstrate that there's a much more interesting, deeper context to the actions Larry had that day, and that any debate we might have about was Larry right to do this, or how should we remember him, that doesn't take into account the longer story of settler colonialism that Larry was confronting, is a completely ahistorical way to do that, and I don't think an honest way to confront it. Larry was not a violent kid. Larry was looking at an entire history and contemporary pattern of violence that was killing his relatives and had been doing that for generations, and he had no other way to confront it. And it was a desperate act, no doubt, and he paid for it with his life. And he's remembered as a warrior and a leader precisely because of that sacrifice. And so, you know, the book tells a multi-generational story over hundreds of years to try to deepen the context within which Larry was struggling against. It's a story about war and occupation and one family's effort to try to confront that, torn apart by all the wars, colonial wars and occupations that really define the last few hundred years for Native people in this country. A country that wouldn't exist without the genocidal campaigns against the Apaches and the Navajos that made possible the world that we live in today. And that's what the story talks about. You know, his father fought in the two bloodiest battles in World War II that Americans fought in Europe, was a POW. His mom was Austrian and was a child war bride, actually brought back by his father after being an occupation soldier following the war in Austria. You know, the entire book is basically a story of U.S. war and occupation and the human cost of that, and then the larger efforts to transform all that that war and violence into a stable occupation. And then the word we have to call that stable occupation is America. And that's the power structure that Larry was confronting. And if we don't place it in that context, then we're not talking about what Larry was doing. And so a lot of the criticisms over the years from non-Native folks in Gallup around Larry are really an effort to try to reinforce the same sort of like myths about Native people, to try to reproduce all the relations of domination that make a place like Gallup exist in the first place.
Can you tell me a little bit more about these relations of domination? Like, what do you mean by that?
Well, Larry was born, he wasn't born in the Navajo Nation. He was born in Santa Rita, New Mexico. And Santa Rita doesn't exist anymore as a city on Earth. It was swallowed up by the copper mine down there. If you've ever driven down from Albuquerque to Silver City, you'll go over the Mimbres Mountains. And just before you get to Bayard, New Mexico, there's this enormous copper mine on the left. Which at the time when Larry was born was owned by a company called Kennecott. And his father was a miner, was like one of the copper miners. And the only reason why this copper mine exists is because of Mexico's genocidal war against the Apache in the 1820s, 30s, and 40s. A war that the Mexican military couldn't win. So it created what it called contratos de sangre, or blood contracts, which was an effort to entice American mercenaries into the region to kill Apaches more efficiently than their military could. And it's only through that war against the Apaches in the 1820s, 30s, and 40s that there is a Silver City or a Santa Rita.
Right.
And then Larry's father works there only because the mining company owned Gamerco, the Gallup American Coal Company. And mm-hmm. during World War II, when Spanish-speaking miners were drafted, they recruited Navajos down there and paid them the least, worked them the hardest, and forced them to live in tents next to the precipitating plant, which was like camping next to a chemical fire. This is where Larry was born. And we have to understand the sort of history of violent conquest to even understand the origins of his family. His dad was drafted, eventually went to World War II, and fought in the Battle of the Hurtgen Woods, and the Battle of the Bulge was taken captive. Most stories, even stories of World War II that focus on just the everyday soldiers, just the grunts taking the brunt of all that military violence, ignore the contribution or the role of Native soldiers who had, again, the most dangerous assignments. Mm-hmm. Actually, were drafted at a higher rate than any other group in the U.S. More than 25,000 Native people served. 6,000 Navajo men were drafted. And, as Larry's father, Lewis, used to say, there's this myth of the Navajo code talkers, but most Navajo men fought in the front lines with guns and took the brunt of it. Yeah. And there's a chapter that demonstrates that, this war that we usually think of as built around freedom and liberty was a war that was in which they just threw Native men as cannon fodder against the Nazis. He was also... came back to New Mexico, had no options, couldn't find work, was starving, had to rejoin the army, and became an occupation soldier in Austria, where he met the woman who would be Larry's mother, Lillian Hutzler. And that story is remarkable. She was 3 when the Nazis invaded her home, 8 when the Allied army was bombing her home, 10 when the Soviets and Americans invaded Salzburg to end the war. And her entire life was turned upside down, and the chapter that tells her story is just another story of war and occupation, upturning lives, destroying lives, and serving the interests of extending the occupation, similar to the occupation of Santa Rita, for example. The chapter about Gallup is a chapter about the political economy of Gallup, but that's a war and an occupation. Mm-hmm. There's nothing that doesn't happen in Gallup that isn't an effort to commodify the economic lives of Native people. My colleague Jennifer here is a chair of the Navajo Nation, and they've been investigating every aspect of that economy, including even the commodification of funerary practices for Native people. And, it's everything, the trading post economy, the way alcohol is sold and regulated. It is a legal structure designed to produce the outcomes that we see as Native immiseration that then get imagined as pathologies of Native people rather than product, political and economic projects of conquest and occupation.
Okay, well, we do need to go to a quick break. This is Let's Talk New Mexico on 89.9 KUNM. I'm Ty Bannerman. We are talking about the story of Larry Casus and the context that he came from. If you remember this story, if you were alive when it was in the news, we'd love to hear from you to share those memories. You can call us at 505-277-5866, and we'll be back in a moment. Welcome back to Let's Talk New Mexico. I'm Ty Bannerman. Today we are focusing on the story of Larry Casus, a young man and Diné activist who, on March 1st, 1973, took the mayor of Gallup, Emmett Garcia, hostage, and then, after an hours-long standoff, died when police opened fire on the building where he stood. I'm joined by David Correa and Dr. Jennifer Dennettdale. Now, Dr. Dennettdale, you are a member of the Navajo Nation, and you were living there when this event occurred. Can you tell us about what it was like for you as a young woman when you heard about this incident?
Okay, first I want to thank my colleague, Dr. Correa, for this very courageous book. I read the book and I wrote a review of it. And I have to say that, I'm an avid reader, and this is a history that's touched me deeply. And this week, David had a couple of book launches one here on UNM campus. And the response from the Navajo people so far has really been one of appreciation for bringing forth this collective memory that we have of Larry Kasus. And so, like many of the Navajo people that I've talked to about this, I also express my appreciation. I'm originally from Tohatchee, which is maybe 25 miles south of Gallup. It's the closest border town to my chapter, Tohatchee. That's where I was spent most of my childhood. And my family continued to live in Tohatchee. And the work that David, our colleagues, Melanie Youngsy and Nick Estes have done spans more, at least 10 years, if not more than 10 years, on looking at border towns, including Gallup, and Albuquerque is also a border town as well. When people talk about borders, they don't think about the borders between designated tribal lands like the Navajo Nation and the economies that exist outside of borders of tribal nations like the Navajo Nation, like Gallup, who exists because of Navajo people. And so I was around 13 years old when this happened in the 1973. For, you know, some history, this was a time of Native indigenous outcry in this country, and some people talk about it as Red Power Rising. And so people don't know about Larry and his actions. They may know the larger pictures of, for example, the American Indian Movement and the demand for justice and indigenous liberation in this country. And Larry was a part of those movements in the 1970s. And so in 1973, as I shared at David's book talk on this last Monday, I was 13 years old and I didn't know anything. You know, I just was aware that something was happening. But I do remember the outrage of the Navajo communities, particularly the young people, when the Gallup Independent published a picture of Larry's body out on the sidewalk with the police standing over it like they had just bagged their trophy. The outrage, I remember at 13 years old, that outrage and the walkouts of the young people from the high schools in the area. I went to Tohatchee High School at that time, Crown Point, Shiprock, Window Rock, you know. And so I remember that. I remember the outrage of Navajo people. And today, when I talk about, we do this work, and as I do this work as the chair of the Navajo Nation Human Rights Commission, I think this book gives me another way. And I had to learn how to acquire the language to be able to name this violence, the border town violence that David is talking about. It's a violence and experience and observation that my Native and my Navajo people know very well.
Now, at that time, did that change the way that you thought of how power structures exist in places like Gallup, or was that something that you kind of knew innately at that time?
I knew that. I knew about the injustices because they're part of our family stories. I mean, one of the things that have come out in just the last two events that David has had is for Navajo people to come forth and talk about their concerns of a place like Gallup. Mm-hmm. You know, and their struggles and their concerns, particularly with the ongoing rampant sale of alcohol in Gallup. I mean, Gallup's population is very small, but the influx of Navajo people is the thousands mm-hmm. on the weekend. And it has more bars and liquor licenses than a town of that size should have. And yet it's the foundation of that city. Alcohol sales have made people incredibly wealthy, non-Indians incredibly wealthy mm-hmm. In Gallup, you know. And so it's you know, I'm very familiar with the experience with what Gallup looks like, you mm-hmm. know.
So it's been almost 50 years at this point. Have things changed for the better in Gallup?
I don't even think that's a legitimate question. You know, I'm not interested in looking at one point A to point B as if there's ever been any kind of progress. That's a white liberal notion. Mm-hmm. You know, I think what David points out and what our work has pointed out is that this violence against indigenous people is called Indian hating and it's called anti-Indianism. Anti-Indianism is coined by the Lakota scholar Elizabeth Cook Glenn, you know, and so it's the structure, it's the very fabric of American society to just hate Indian people.
I see. So what is the answer then? Like, how can things be made better?
You know, the conversations that we've had and the work of my colleagues, particularly the young people, I think is very important to the struggles. It was in, I think David said in 2013 when he met the Cassous sisters, and it was here in Albuquerque actually, when the Kiva Club, Larry was president of the Kiva Club in 1973, and it was, I think it's in 2013, when the Kiva Club held an event to remember Larry, you know, and so their remembrance of him and their honoring of him, I think, is really important in carrying on the work that Larry thought was really important. And the work was to call out and to refuse this constant racism and hatred of Indian people, you know. And so the work just continues. It continues in the work of a local, they have a, the organization, the Red Nation, you know, continues to work and think about Larry in a very generative way.
Mm-hmm. What lessons can we learn from a story like Larry's? Give us a call at 505-277-5866 or email letstalk@kunm.org and tell us your thoughts. Now, Dr. Dennettdale, as I mentioned, among your other duties as a UNM American Studies chair. You are also the chair of the Navajo Nation Human Rights Commission. And I wonder if you can talk about how the work that you do with that organization relates to the legacy of Larry Cassous.
Okay. When we met Larry and Melody Yazzie and Nick Estes and all three of us, we found a common interest in terms of creating and bringing forth border town and border town violence as an area of study, you know, and so we had that common interest. I've been the chair. This is my second term as chair of the Navajo Nation Human Rights Commission, and I think I've served. I might be in my 11th year. I'm not keeping count. But the Navajo Nation Human Rights Commission is the only kind of its education that is part of a tribal nation within the United States. And the commission was established when Clint John, a Navajo man in Farmington was shot and killed by Farmington police in 2006, you know. And so it's the only entity that takes a human rights, international human rights frame and puts it in conversation with Diné philosophy, you know. And it addresses specifically Navajo citizens' claims to having experienced racism and discrimination in boundaries outside of the Navajo Nation, you know. And so we've done some really important work. It's hard work to do. We have an excellent staff, excellent executive director, and there's just so many issues. We've been very successful, and we spent the last couple of years on voting rights, Navajo citizens' voting rights, you know, and we now are in a lawsuit with San Juan County in New Mexico, you know, and that's public, so I can say that. we have been taking on predatory auto financing in Gallup, New Mexico. I mean, that doesn't even make a dent in the incredible amount of predatory kinds of businesses in Gallup. I mean, my own people will tell me about the payday loans, and that at the first of the month, you'll see a line of elders standing in line to pay their what they owe the payday loans, right. And they will never pay that off.
Yeah,
you know, and it's really hard to try to get the legislature to change that because mm-hmm. it's profitable for the city of Gallup and other border towns around the Navajo Nation.
Now we have been talking a lot about Gallup specifically, but as you mentioned, these are power structures and racist issues that you see throughout, well, certainly New Mexico and probably further than that. Can you talk a little bit about how they manifest in places where, you know, in Gallup, it may be very visible with the alcohol problem and that kind of thing. But what about a place like Albuquerque or other parts of New Mexico?
You know, I think I want to have David help me with that question because, and I'm not remembering the year that two Navajo men were brutally mutilated and tortured by Hispanic young men. Mm-hmm. I don't remember what year that was.
It was early 2015, I believe.
Okay, 2015. And so there's, you know, Albuquerque has this population of, and a majority of them are Navajo people mm-hmm. who are on the streets here in Albuquerque. And that's a common experience. The term Indian rolling was coined, and people apply it to farm Indians, particularly what they call the Chokecherry Massacre. When white teenage boys, men, murdered, mutilated, horrifically tortured Navajo men in Farmington in the mm-hmm. 1970s, around the same time that Larry Casus, you know, was addressing these issues with other Navajo people, and so Albuquerque has not done anything that's productive in addressing this homeless issue. Mm-hmm. Leaders in border towns like Farmington, like Gallup and Albuquerque continue to declare that it's a Navajo Nation problem, mm-hmm. you know, and Navajo leaders have not been very, neither have Pueblo leaders been very good about addressing it either, mm-hmm. you know. And so we came, the Human Rights Commission came into Albuquerque during that period when the two Navajo men, Rabbit and Cowboy, were murdered and took public testimony. And we talked to people on the streets, Nick Estes and Melanie Niazi. I wrote one of the articles, did a series of articles on these issues. You know, we went into, was raised in and out of Gallup, and we went to Gallup and we talked to people. But the policies, laws, and ordinances are put in place just to try to make people go away. They're not in any way productive or meaningful to change people's lives or to provide resources that might make a difference. Mm-hmm. So, David, do you remember that period when we were doing that work?
Yeah, we spent a lot of time on the street talking to unsheltered Native people, and I didn't think I talked to anybody that didn't have a similar story about cops harassing them and telling them to go back to the reservation, even though they were born and raised in or around Albuquerque. This idea that Native people don't belong, of course, is a mm-hmm. common trope of settler society. It's like you don't belong. Their very presence is a challenge to, and even progressive politics in, mm-hmm. in a settler world, which puts, you know, the idea of progress at the heart of it. Like things are getting better. We're trying mm-hmm. our best. But of course, that effort happens within a context that requires Native dispossession of land, mm-hmm. and that's constant dispossession that extends to every part of life, economic life, educational opportunities, employment opportunities. You know, I mean, debt is weaponized against Native people in every way imaginable, and the, you know, the example of alcohol, I think, is a perfect one because it's become such an easy way to pathologize Native people who drink on the street, and no one bothers to really look at the structure of this. Mm-hmm. The legal and regulatory framework of drinking makes it impossible for Native people really to do anything but drink where it's illegal. It's illegal to have it on the reservation. That's a long tradition, sort of a settler tradition of like equating alcohol with Indianness and so restricting it. the you know, I mean, in the territorial period in New Mexico, all the Indian agents were just obsessed with alcohol consumption, and it became a tactic of social control, and that happens today. Silicon Gallup, for example, you know, in the 70s when Larry was operating, it was the largest drunk tank in the United States. They made more arrests per capita than anywhere else in the United States, almost mm-hmm. entirely Navajo people. When Jennifer and the Navajo Nation Human Rights Commission were in Albuquerque, so much of the testimony were people describing being arrested for alcohol. They'd never had a drink in their life. Mm-hmm. But it was just, oh, you're native and you're on the street. You must be drunk, hauling them to the drunk tank. We're talking about 20, 30,000 a year, these arrests in places like Gallup. You know, in the 70s, the penalty for driving drunk was less than possessing alcohol on the Navajo reservation. So the reasonable way to bring alcohol back to the Navajo reservation was in the stomach. Mm-hmm. And that, of course, produced all these obvious results, the drunk driving accidents and the deaths related to alcohol. And then when folks would come into Gallup, most places wouldn't allow Native people to even enter their establishment, signs saying no Indians mm-hmm. allowed. And so most of the drinking had to happen in like packaged liquor stores. And so people were, the only legal place to drink if you were Native in the 70s in Gallup was where it was illegal, on the streets or in the alleys where they were most vulnerable to vigilantes or cops. Mm-hmm. And in Gallup at the time and today, the line between vigilantes and police is a very blurry one. And I don't say that to be provocative. I say that empirically. Like the evidence of that we can find in the arrest records and in the legal cases against it. And it's all in this book because we don't need to have debates about who's responsible and personal responsibility mm-hmm. when we can actually see that we have systems created and designed specifically to produce these outcomes.
Well, as Dr. Dunnedale said, kind of the white liberal approach might be we change this law, we right. change that law. But it seems perhaps that what you are saying is what we need is a major change in mindset and...
Well, it's a structural change. I mean, the demand for land back is not a metaphor. It's mm-hmm. not a polite request, may we please have our land back. Anything short of that is a reformist approach that's designed mm-hmm. just to sort of sustain a settler society based on that dispossession. Mm-hmm. And if it sounds naive to you to have someone say the only solution to these problems is to the return of native land, your naivete is based on histories of great violence mm-hmm. that have stolen these lands. And so to deny land back is to defend that history of violence and to sustain a status quo that continues to produce the same outcomes that Larry fought against 50 years ago is to defend a status quo that will continue to do that. There is no reforming a system designed to produce these outcomes. And so, you know, Larry was very, it's one of the reasons why Larry is a hero as a warrior, because he was principled in this way. He understood there was no compromise on this issue. Even though he had tried, he understood mm-hmm. that there are short-term goals and people are going to die tomorrow, and so what can I do today to help them from dying tomorrow? And the solution was, can we just move the bar back a little bit mm-hmm. from the road? He understood that wasn't the solution, but at least it could save some lives. And even that was naive. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you don't understand, Larry. That's not how things are done. And so, you know, he confronted a system that thwarted Native demands at every level, diminished them, disputed every claim, marginalized every political struggle. And so the outcome that you know, on March 1st, 1973, when police killed Larry Kasus, is understood by Native people in this country as the outcome that we could look at any border town and see people like Larry Kasus. Mm-hmm. He's not unusual, but he's courageous and for standing up against it and confronting it. And by doing it, he forces us to look very honestly, or he ought to force us to look very honestly at that history and then refuse to look away from what needs to be done to address it. And all we've done as a settler society is look away from it because mm-hmm. all of our privileges are based on that dispossession and violence. And that's his memory. That's the legacy. That's why he's contested, right? That's why his memory is contested in places like Gallup, because the only way to avoid having that very uncomfortable conversation is by dismissing Larry's complaints as legitimate in the first place. And they weren't just his. These were collective complaints and a collective experience of violence.
Well, it is time for a quick break. You are listening to Let's Talk New Mexico on 89.9 KUNM. I'm Ty Bannerman. There's still time to weigh in on today's conversation. You can call us at 505-277-5866 or email letstalk@kunm.org. Welcome back to Let's Talk New Mexico on KUNM. I'm Ty Bannerman. Today we are discussing the legacy of Larry Casus. There is still time to call in, 505-277-5866. I'm joined by Dr. David Correa, Dr. Jennifer Dennett-Dale, and now I am going to bring in another guest, Alicia Gallegos, who is a member of UNM's Kiva Club. Good morning, Alicia.
Hello, good morning.
Thank you so much for joining us today. So the UNM Kiva Club was founded in 1952, making it UNM's oldest organization for Native American students and one of the oldest in the United States. And as we mentioned, Larry Casus was president of the organization. How is he viewed by members of the club today?
I would say we're definitely trying to still remember him and all that he has done for our Native people through different ways, but definitely through education, because a lot of our members, including myself, didn't know who Larry Casus was until we kind of came back in person this school year and had a discussion about him, where we had some older or Kiva Club alumni kind of educate us on like the history of Kiva Club, how it's historically known and how it's been active throughout these decades. And then, of course, you can't talk about the history of Kiva Club without talking about Larry Casus. So we were lucky to have some alumni with us to tell us his story as well.
Now, can you tell me what the Kiva Club does? What is it? What sort of issues does it address?
So Kiva Club, like you mentioned, is one of the oldest Native student orgs kind of here in the country. So with that, we focus a lot on Indigenous issues and how we can educate not only our Indigenous people, but, you know, allies or others who are in the community with us about the experiences we go through here in urban areas, but also here, like on the reservations and things like that. And so we do a lot of work to, like, not only educate, but also kind of be active in mm-hmm. the community and bring real action to what we're talking about. But, yeah, so, like, because in the past you've heard about, like, Kiva Club being able to change UNM's seal that had racist mm-hmm. tropes on it. And now we're still trying to figure out what actions can be taken to change, you know, some of the building names here on campus that really kind of idolize the conquistadors who genocided our people in New Mexico.
And I should point out that we are broadcasting from the Oñate building here on UNM campus, although it is no longer written on any sign outside. We have a call from Carmen in Santa Fe. Good morning, Carmen. What would you like to add to the conversation today?
Thank you. Good morning. I just wanted to say that I'm enjoying the presentation. I'm enjoying it in the sense of learning something about it, but not enjoying it in the sense that it's such a sad situation mm-hmm. that back then and still today, Native people are still being treated unfairly. And Farmington also treats Native people unfairly as well. Mm-hmm. And it's just sad that this happened in Gallup and that people were put in jail just because they were Native. It doesn't surprise me back then, and even today the world is the way the world treats people of color. Mm-hmm. And I'm just glad that we're hearing it and talking about it and not erasing the history. So thank you.
Thank you so much for calling in, Carmen. Now I wanted to go back to Alicia Gallegos, who is the secretary of UNM's Kiva Club. And I wanted to know, what was it that drew you to join the Kiva Club when you came to UNM?
Yeah, that's a good question, because, you know, I started UNM in 2019, and so by that time, I would say I had been just a little bit exposed to some of our issues that Indigenous people face. My later high school years, like I really started being aware of our conditions that we are living under in, here in the U.S. Through the No DAPL protests, and then slowly with the MMIWR situation. So once I kind of like got a grasp on that, I knew like there was something that was kind of being kept from us as Native people in our education, something that was being silenced or erased so that we wouldn't know what we are living through, you know? And so when I got to UNM and I heard about Native American studies, I was like, oh, this is something I have to, like, I need to take these courses. And then kind of through that, I learned about Kiva Club. So, but it was my freshman year, so I was just kind of trying to get used to the college mm-hmm. life, and I didn't really know how to contact Kiva Club. So, and then unfortunately, when the pandemic happened and we were all at home, I was still kind of unsure if like Kiva Club was active or not. But when this school year rolled around, I saw them tabling for our welcome back days, and I was like, oh, finally I can join. And I signed up and I started attending all the meetings. And then shortly after, like maybe just the second meeting, I was like, oh, maybe I should try and run for an officer position because I really want to commit myself to this type of work. Mm-hmm. And so I ran for vice president, unfortunately didn't get it, but so I was like, okay, next best thing is secretary. I love taking notes, but yeah, so I really enjoyed getting to know our Indigenous students here on campus who care about these issues and want to bring light to them. And not only that, but want to celebrate Indigenous life. You know, there's so much more to us than our traumatic history. There's stuff to celebrate. We bring our culture and traditions here on campus. For example, today we'll be having a luncheon, and we're going to be bringing our Pueblo dance group to come and, you know, bless the space and start us off in prayer. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's kind of something that you wouldn't see in other, like, kind of Western institutions where that stuff can be ignored. You know, we need our Native people to be here and advocate for those kinds of things.
Can you tell me what is the importance of Larry Kasusa's story to you?
I would have to say after reading Dr. Correa's book, I learned so much more about what he stood for and the context that he was coming from. The professors were talking about before, you know, this kind of experience is not too unique. You know, we kind of all face, we live the stuff that Larry was witnessing when he was seeing Native people being arrested by police or seeing Native people suffer from alcoholism. So kind of learning about how he approached that situation was really inspiring to me. And I really saw how our ancestors' courageous spirit can really continue on to these newer generations, you know. Mm-hmm. Although that was, because 1973, that's not too long ago. So just really learning how he started out with trying to reach out to those Navajo Inn bar owners and saying, you know, this isn't right. You need to remove yourself. You need to distance yourself from the Navajo people because this is hurting our people, you know. And he started out with that kind of approach, but like we've seen time and time again, his voice wasn't taken seriously, and he was told that, you know, what he was like, you can't do that, or, you know, things like that. So the fact that he had to kind of go to that extreme extent is really saddening, but at the same time, he can be remembered for what the things we have to go through to be heard. Mm-hmm. And so I really want to bring that spirit of resistance to Kiva Club, or with Kiva Club, you know, because he did that with maybe one other person, I think. And so, but we have a whole organization here on campus. So it's like, how can we organize as a group of people so that we don't have to go to that extent again and experience that type of violence again, you know?
Mm-hmm. We have a call from Ed in Albuquerque. Good morning, Ed. What would you like to add to the conversation?
Good morning.
Howdy. What would you like to say today?
I just want to say thank you to your panel. I personally am from Mobile, Alabama. I have a son who's half Navajo. We lost his mother to some of the things that you're talking about. But I want to say thank you because the message that you're speaking is very enlightening to someone like me who doesn't know the history out here in New Mexico and the struggle. Mm-hmm. And that point that the gentleman made about the system and not trying to take the time to point the finger, but to look at the system and how the system is driving some of these issues. I never was looked at it that way. And it was such an amazing point, especially coming from someone like myself. I come from a family where they went to segregated schools, and I'm the first in my family to not have to go through that. Mm-hmm. And I have a son that I'm trying to balance between my culture home and his culture out here. And I really want him to know and understand, you know, the plight out here and respect it and be able to do what Larry did, you know, stand up and put up the good fight. And walk directly into that land, you know. Mm-hmm. Those are not my words, but I just think that's an amazing story, and it's disheartening that those things happened to all those Native men back in the 70s, mm-hmm. that brutality. So, but I just want to thank you guys for, you know, sharing that history and helping somebody like me see both sides of these this history.
You're welcome, Ed.
Yeah, thanks so much for calling in, Ed. And David, did you want to respond?
I don't know how to respond. That was beautiful.
We also have a call from Veronica, also in Albuquerque. Good morning, Veronica. What would you like to share today?
I'm sorry, I can't quite hear you.
Oh, it's okay. What would you like to share today?
I just would like to share that I was a student at the same time Larry Kassous was at UNM. Mm-hmm. Just from my perspective over all these many years, it seems to me, having known Larry at that time, it was kind of a lonely fight for him. Mm-hmm. It was lonely in the fact that, as mentioned earlier, people didn't understand what he was objecting to. People did not see the broad spectrum of the issues that he was trying to bring forth. And so when I think of Larry Kassous, I think of him as a lonely warrior. Mm-hmm. The good that did come out after the event, as I'll call it, was that there was a unification. There was a broader understanding. There was more of an acknowledgement from the New Mexico community, as particularly the Native community. So when I think of Larry Kassous, I think of him as a lonely warrior.
Well, thank you so much for calling in, Veronica. David, would you like to respond?
Well, thank you for that, Veronica. I think that in a lot of ways, that's true. You know, Larry and Robert, what they did on March 1st, 1973, they did alone. It was all of their friends and comrades and Indians Against Exploitation and Kiva Club were unaware that they were doing it. And the last chapter of the book is a hour by hour account of the last 2 days of his life, partly. And it does demonstrate that sort of, like, he was really, he had really lost a lot of faith in the kind of struggle they were waging collectively. But, you know, his death, you know, Jennifer was at the funeral. There was thousands of people came out. You know, he felt alone in that moment. And it's part of the tragedy is that he really wasn't. He had so many. Mm-hmm. He was part of a real movement and community that had his back. And it's part of the tragedy that, mm-hmm. that he saw the struggle ending that way for him. But I appreciate Veronica's comment.
Okay, and Dr. Dunnett-Dale?
Yeah, just briefly, I want to say that this Larry story is also a part of UNM history, because Emmett Garcia was nominated as regent of a board of regent for the University of Mexico, and Larry went to all means necessary to protest and refuse that, and that led to March 1st, 1973. But in the larger picture, Larry was part of the tradition of indigenous resistance. We're not privy to that. That's not part of the histories that we're told, you know. And so we need to remember that he was part of that long, long history of indigenous resistance. It's a tradition.
And I wanted to say what Jennifer and I are going to be at the Red Nation office on Friday at 6 to 8 p.m. That's 1421 Central Avenue. To talk about this book and about Larry Cassous, Friday, 6 to 8 p.m., 1421 Central Avenue, and also in Gallup this Saturday downtown at the Downtown Conference Center, again, 6 o'clock, talking about the book and Larry Cassous with his family members. They'll be there on Friday in Albuquerque and then on Saturday in Gallup. And we'll be at the flea market in Gallup also from like 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. With the book and with the Red Nation and with members of Larry's family.
Okay, and that is all the time that we have today. Thanks to everyone who called in to share your thoughts. Thanks so much to our guests, Alicia Gallegos, David Correa, Dr. Jennifer Dennettdale. If you missed part of the show, you can stream it online or subscribe to our podcast, which you can find anywhere you find your favorite podcasts. Our engineer is Marino Spencer. Daniel Montano handled the phones today. Cave Movahead produced the show, and Robert Maldonado live tweeted. I am Ty Bannerman, and this is Let's Talk New Mexico on 89.9 KUNM.